The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Awkward in Iceland.
Mr. Prime Minister, what can you tell me about a company called Vintris?
Well, it's a company, if I recall correctly.
That is Iceland's Prime Minister Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson being asked about some secret shell company he may have created. It's just a tiny part of the revelations from the biggest financial leak of offshore tax shelters and secret bank accounts in history. Billions of documents implicating hundreds of public officials. Just the beginning of understanding what came out of a leak from a law firm in Panama named Mossack Fonseca. James Henry is former chief economist at McKinsey and an attorney who's written extensively on the inner workings of clandestine financial networks. How do you stumble into this world? How does it find you? James Henry says it's quite easy to imagine.
Well, if you imagine the bar at Star Wars, you have a collection of characters from all over the planet. You have money launderers, you have arms dealers, you have, in this case, leading public officials. I think we're now up to 140 public officials, including quite a few prime ministers. And what they're gathered to do is to, basically keep their offshore wealth secret. And places like Panama in this case, but, more than 91 havens around the world basically act as conduits to the ultimate investing places like the United States and the UK and Switzerland, providing secrecy for lots of people who are up to dubious activities.
Now, I get the drug cartel business and the money laundering for, like blackmail and counterfeiters for that matter. I know what they have to do, and they've got the phone numbers scrawled on their little notebooks, and it's been that way for hundreds of years. But if somebody gets into public office, it seems to me the last thing you want to do is pick up the phone and go inquiring around in some strange sort of way. So how does the pitch happen, or how does somebody ask around? I mean, that's the thing that's so mysterious to me.
Well, this is not something that you do as you're in your own capacity. There's a whole industry, the global haven industry, that consists of leading law firms, banks, accounting firms. And in this case, one particular 42 million revenue bank law firm in Panama. And they're enablers. They basically, Vladimir Putin didn't go to Panama to set up his accounts. His people talk to other people, and one thing leads to another. But it's basically a network of sophisticated professionals who are making a very nice living simply by offering secrecy and financial chicanery for the world's elite. In this case, we've shined light on another particularly egregious kind of behavior, which is kleptocracy. This is you usually talk about these places as tax havens, but in fact, in this case, we have public officials all over the planet helping themselves to the public treasury and then getting rich and then hiding the money offshore. So the prime minister of Pakistan, the president of Ukraine. There's no proof at this point absolutely that these people have been guilty of crimes, but there's certainly a lot of smoke, and investigators are now going to spend a lot of time going through these files very, very carefully.
And it's a peculiar version of public service. I mean, I've served my people, and, I need a little security in my later years. Don't you think I should have that, James?
Well, they seem to feel entitled. But for many developing countries, this is a much more serious problem than tax dodging. or even financial chicanery. This involves, you know, their political classes engaged in corruption, selling their services to private interests, and allowing themselves to be able to conceal the fruits of all this offshore and then enjoy it after they leave office. We have quite a few ex-prime ministers here implicated as well. So, you know, this is not new behavior. We have known about this for 40, 50 years. I mean, in the 1970s, I was going to, you know, I was covering a case called the Castle Bank and Trust that involved offshore havens. In the 1980s, I went to Panama and ran across this very same law firm, which was helping Noriega at that point. And we've had case after case from the Marcos money to the BCCI to the latest scandals involving Credit Suisse and UBS and wealthy Americans. We've just known about this for years. The puzzle has always been why we didn't really have the world community crack down on it. And I think we're now beginning to understand that.
Is there a world governance solution here where you could tie the financial system so closely into a transparent, globally watched institution that this sort of thing would be almost impossible to do except on a very small scale?
I think the answer is yes. The real issues here are political, not technical. For example, if you simply had a requirement that banks have to know their customers, and that means not just knowing the companies that they are showing up, but also knows who the beneficial owners are, and that those beneficial owners of companies and trusts have to be registered and public, so we know who the owners actually are. That would go a major way toward cleaning some of this up. If you had public officials have to declare their offshore wealth, their onshore wealth, and file tax returns in public, that would be another simple measure that we could adopt. But it's not something that any one country can do alone, and I think that's one of the problems. You have to get countries together, and many of the wealthiest countries, like the United States and UK, have very powerful banking lobbies that have resisted that because a lot of this money ultimately ends up not in the haven countries, but back in the first world. But
my last question is, I mean, I love talking to you, McKenzie folks, because, I mean, I may be overstating the case, but, you know, I get the feeling that you see everything in the universe. You know, you're not obviously part of this world, but you get a sort of a bigger snapshot of how things are done in the very sort of high levels of government, et cetera. And I just have to figure this leak has just got disgruntled former employee. Hi, I can fix you. You're out of business now. All over it, don't you think?
I've known quite a few whistleblowers, and in my experience, most of them are pretty well-motivated in the sense of not being necessarily having personal motives for doing this. It may be the case. We don't know at this point. But a lot of whistleblowers just want to do the right thing. And the problem has been, and this is not only in the case of the banking industry, but also we've seen, you know, our own government cracking down on journalists and their sources. They're not treated very well. And so one of the themes here that's very important to recognize is that this kind of revelation, the largest leak in history, didn't come about by virtue of law enforcement or governments. It came about by virtue of a combination of a network of journalists all across the planet and a few whistleblowers who stepped forward. And so I like to think that those people need to be helped and rewarded for, and at least commended for their behavior.
Well, certainly we want to encourage it. And certainly the sense that this firm has been working for quite a long time makes me feel as though anybody this close to what's going on must have moved from being part of the action to being part of the solution. But how that is the case, only prosecutors will know from here on out. But thanks so much for talking to us about this.
You're very welcome.
James Henry, former chief economist at McKinsey and an attorney who's written extensively on the inner workings of clandestine financial networks. So a massive data leak raises questions about the rich and powerful and all their money. How free should people be to keep financial secrets from Newport, Rhode Island? Financial privacy should be paramount because hackers can do greater damage to those who are not rich.
This is Becky from Minneapolis. And in this particular breach, I don't feel sorry for the people involved. I feel like, you know, people in general are corrupt. And if these people are corrupt, they should own it. And then we, the people, need to do something about it.
From Ambler, Pennsylvania, they can keep secrets, but evading taxes is illegal. Maybe some income concessions for privacy are acceptable because personal finances need not be anyone's business unless someone is doing something illegal. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. You can comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Time to go length of the court with Archie Diacono. 3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins for the championship.
Wow. There is nothing more magical than a buzzer-beating three-point shot to win a national championship. When you're the underdog, your opponent, North Carolina, is bigger than you, but Villanova did it. Chris Jenkins made the shot, living every basketball dreamer's dream as the clock went to zero, bringing the title back to Villanova for the first time in 31 years. Jim Nance and Bill Raftery making that call on TBS. Pretty classic. Here's the Westwood One radio call by Kevin Kugler.
Flips to Jenkins. Three for the win. It's good! It's good!
Jenkins! Nice, Kev. Those radio guys, got to give them some credit. Takes a lot of firepower, by the way, to blow all those streamers. That's what you're hearing. Here's the call from TNT's broadcast where North Carolina fans could tune in to hear a hometown favoring broadcast team of West Durham and Brendan Haywood.
Into Ryan Archie Diacono, he'll come front court. Works for Jenkins, a three at the horn.
Oh no. There is no time but real time. Canal Plus's broadcast from Spain, listen. Villanova. I am fluent in Spanish. After that, I'm fluent. And here's Viasat in Russia. That's how you say awesome in Russian. The visuals of the Villanova cheerleaders' absolute shock and joy is barely matched. And if you see the replays, you gotta look at them. By True TV's Villanova All the Way team of Scott Graham and Brian Finner.
Ball in his hand. Archie Diacono for Jenkins for the win. Yeah!
Oh, that's just too good. Congrats to the Villanova Wildcats 2016 NCAA Men's Basketball Champs. This is the takeaway for the win! Yes! We did it!
Support for the takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years. With services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
The general expectation is the unemployment rate will be unchanged at 4.9%.
Bosses are adding a lot of jobs, 215,000.
Central tendency of the inflation is 1.5 to 1.6%.
6.3% in March.
Slow growth is coming from slow productivity growth. You know, output per worker has not been growing quickly.
Enough is enough.
Bring back booming economic growth.
The defining economic challenge of our time is clear. Clear.
If oil prices don't explain things the way they used to economically, how about China? This week we are seeking clarity of the increasingly complex state of the global economy as part of our series, The 2016 Economic Fog, Finding a Way Forward. China is big, this we know, but the numbers are hard to decipher. Growth rates in China have fallen from 10.6% in 2011 to 6.8% in 2015, and with a rough start to 2016, the country's economic and financial woes have prompted fears of a global recession. Lisa Emsbo-Mattingly is director of research in the Global Asset Allocation Group at Fidelity Investments. She says it's not the straight-ahead numbers that worry her. It's China's new capacity to pull the unexpected from its deck.
A lot of surprises coming out of the Chinese economy over the last 6 months. What keeps me awake is how stable the Chinese economy is, what's going to happen with their currency, what are the growth drivers going forward for the Chinese economy.
And where in China is there disposable cash for them to begin investing around the world? We've certainly heard for years about the Chinese holding American debt, but China is actually investing in real assets. And it's not just in, African natural resources. It's in companies in the United States.
I think that comes back to sort of this, to some extent, a trap that China finds itself in. It has a currency that has strengthened over the years, and that certainly improves the ability of Chinese companies to go externally outside of China and buy companies, but it also hampers their competitiveness globally.
You know, I'm old enough to remember the 70s and 80s when the Japanese were making similar kinds of purchases, and there was all this nationalistic talk about how Japan is the strongman economy and that the U.S. is a mess. And in hindsight, that whole Japanese period looked like capital flight. I mean, people were taking capital out of Japan and investing it anywhere but Japan. Is that possibly what's going on in China as well, that there's a concern about investing in China?
Yes, that's definitely one of the concerns. One of the big issues that people have focused on in terms of Chinese holdings has been, as you mentioned, the very big holdings of U.S. treasuries in their foreign reserves. That's to maintain that stable currency versus the U.S. dollar. But over the last year, those reserves have fallen quite considerably. And from the peak of almost $4 trillion in foreign reserves, they're down to about $3.2 trillion. So we've seen a lot more money exiting the Chinese economy than entering over the last year.
Looking ahead 50 years, what do you think China will have had the most influence on? A continuing presence in manufacturing or something radically different?
I do think that there is potential, and the key word is potential, for the Chinese to become very dynamic in their financial services industry. Every year when I go back to China, whether it's internet finance or investment trusts or wealth management products, every year there's an entire new industry that's created in China. Some of that is going to not end well, but I do think that they probably are at the very front end of quite a bit of innovation in finance.
Is the U.S. insulated from a Chinese downturn?
I would argue that we've already seen a Chinese downturn, and it certainly has affected the global economy. The U.S. manufacturing sector has been impacted, I think. The U.S. dollar has been impacted by all of those changes that we've already seen coming out of China. But the U.S. does not appear to be going into recession as a result.
Lisa Emsbo-Mattingly is director of research in the Global Asset Allocation Group at Fidelity Investments. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
China's size makes it difficult to imagine the realities of doing business there sometimes. Brian Yu is founder and CEO of Business Connect China, where from Beijing, he helps investors and corporations, both foreign and domestic, to better understand China and its market potential. He says while the rest of the world wrings their hands over the Chinese economy, he only sees progress over the past decade.
Right now, it's much easier to do business in China than, let's say, 10 or even 20 years ago, because the government control over the economy has been weakened. And then the private economy is really sort of taking off. Particularly, this is good news for the media and small-sized business, if it's a kind of a foreign business, because in the past, you always has to do business with state-owned enterprise or need support from the government. And now things have changed a lot.
As a business person, do I want access to the consumer market in China? Is that what I'm really going for? Or do I want access to the technical expertise and the manufacturing expertise in China?
If this question is asked, let's say, about 5 years ago, I would say China was more in this manufacturing, made in China, global factory. But things also have changed. The consumer economy is really taking off. In 2015, we did see the booming of the consumer power because the emerging of the huge, huge middle class in China, according to the statistics, is exceeding 100 million. I would say now is really a good time to tap into this market. And also the interesting difference between now and, let's say, 5 years ago is that these consumer economy is really sort of segmented at the geographic level and also at the, let's say, age level. So this is actually good news for those small brands in the U.S. because they can cater into some specific needs in specific segments, and then they have a better winning chance in China than in the past.
What if I wanted to come to China and start a rock band?
Wow. Rock band is in the, let's put it into cultural industry, and
right.
Also this is media related.
Yep.
In this aspect, I would say overall cultural industry is taking off, but if it's related to media, let's say people opinions, I don't think they are really doing that well than the other industries. Some of the popular music, if it's not like so opinionated or it's not like anti, you know, government or those kind of bands, I mean, they are really, really doing well.
How hard was it for you to set up your own business, Business Connect China?
My business has been 7 years now. It's been pretty easy. And I don't have much interference or relationship with the government, but I do observe the laws and the regulations, and I need to be very sensitive in terms of what's the changes in the government control, in terms of scrutiny, in terms of how you gather information. So I'm fully aware of all this kind of environment. So overall, 7 years, I don't have any difficulty in terms of working with the government.
Brian Yu, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Brian Yu is CEO and founder of Business Connect China. He's got a bright outlook for China, but the Chinese won't be reading about the Panama Papers anytime soon. China appears to be censoring social media posts on the leak, which has named several members of the Chinese elite, including the brother-in-law, President Xi Jinping.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
6 years ago, this nation's Faustian bargain with Carbon Energy played itself out in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster that killed 29 out of 31 miners trapped in a hell of darkness, fire, and poison gas. A partial accounting of that tragedy will be registered in the sentencing tomorrow of the CEO of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, who after a lengthy investigation and trial has been found guilty on 4 criminal counts of negligence and safety violations, for which the most he can be sentenced is a year in jail and fined $250,000. Friday, underscoring the bloody trade-off between energy demand and worker protections, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin signed a bill that actually weakens some mining safety requirements in West Virginia. Joining us is Ashton Mara. She's assistant news director at West Virginia Public Broadcasting and has been covering the mining story for the last 6 years. Welcome, Ashton.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Faustian bargain, this idea that coal miners are disposable and that executives are to be treated with kid gloves, that's very much on the minds of community members in West Virginia today, I suspect. Yes?
It is. Over the weekend, I spoke with the sisters of one man. His name was Howard Payne. Howard was 53 years old, just a few years away from retirement. His sisters, Shirley Witt and Sherry DePoy, immediately following the conviction, were obviously disappointed with the amount of time that Blankenship could face and the amount of money potentially he could have to pay.
I still wish he could have more, because I think that those men's lives were worth more than being punished for 12 months and a fine of 250,000 marks. But for me, the most important thing that can come out of that is that we see from this that the laws will change. And so far, we're not seeing that.
Even the small amount of time in prison, even the small amount of fine that they say he faces, for them, justice will come by Congress making a change. For these men and women at the top of these companies to show that they care about and weigh the safety of the men and women who are working in dangerous conditions every day.
And to be accountable. And this is an uneasy time for the West Virginia coal mines, in that coal demand is down and the financial pressures are up for the companies, and I suspect that has something to do with why the governor signed this law last Friday.
It plays a piece. West Virginia as a whole is going through a tough financial time right now, and a portion of that has to do with the coal mining and the natural gas industries, both of which West Virginia relies on for severance taxes, or the money that they make off of those resources being pulled from the ground. The governor did sign a bill on Friday that weakens some of those safety standards, but I spoke with a member of the House of Delegates yesterday who is actually a representative of the United Mine Workers of America. And he signed on as a sponsor of this bill. It does some minor things. It changes some of the fines if there should be a mine accident. It gives the director of the State Department of Environmental Protection more oversight about how much that fine would be. There's some minor authority changes to the state mine EMT teams. So the teams who are trained to go in after a disaster and actually try to save some of the miners who might be underground and assess those situations. But this delegate said to me, you know, I wouldn't have signed on to a bill that did so much that it put our workers at risk.
Although, you know, the interesting thing about this trial and Don Blankenship, he was not charged with a much more severe criminal penalty, which would involve negligence in the kind of ventilation in that mine, which some safety inspections found was inadequate, that the miners were not adequately ventilated, and that's what caused the accumulation of gas, the explosion, and then the deaths.
Right. So the prosecution brought this out. This was a key part of their case in the trial in the fall. And in Massey as a whole, which was a very large company, you know, publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange, Upper Big Branch always rated at the top for the number of violations, and a number of those came because of ventilation problems. Ventilation is necessary to, you know, get clean air into the mine, not just for these miners to breathe, but also to push out that explosive coal dust that comes from the mining process. And in the three investigations that came after the explosion, they were a mix of federal and state investigations, you know, they essentially blamed Massey and said excessive amounts of coal dust underground, this poor ventilation system, those were what were to blame for the explosion, for the deaths of those miners.
But prosecutors apparently could not pin that directly on Blankenship, and so here we are.
I would just say that the reason that prosecutors weren't able to pin that on Blankenship is because of the system we have itself. There's a system in place in American corporations to protect people at the very top from things that happen at the lower levels. They're not supposed to be found as being negligent for things that happen on the ground. So the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Southern West Virginia was really attempting to do something that's never been done before. A CEO, a top CEO at a company, has never been tried for essentially what was a workplace accident. And what it comes down to is there just aren't laws in place that allow them to charge him with the deaths of those miners, or charge him with negligence that led to the deaths of those miners. They did the best that they could do, and the only charge they really had at their disposal was what he was found guilty of, this conspiracy to willfully violate federal mine safety laws. And like you said, that's only a misdemeanor.
Ashton, a memorial today, that will be more than a little ceremony, yes?
Yes, it will. Of course, we have these 29 men, and we can expect all of those families, all of their families, to be there, members of the community. how a mine works is there are three shifts, and this explosion only affected one shift at that mine. So you can expect to see dozens of other miners who worked in that same mine to be there today as well. It will certainly be an emotional memorial.
Ashton Mara is Assistant News Director at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much, Ashton.
Thank you.
As a personal matter, home is many things in America. The rented flat, the tent in the wilderness, the trailer home always on the move. The development of distinctly American houses is a saga that merges indigenous culture with European dreams of farms and freedom, and the planning of cities, which developed in America often with very little thought on how and where people would actually live. Thomas Jefferson thought a lot about this at his residence in Monticello, Virginia. Architect Frank Lloyd Wright yearned to mix the landscape with his Falling Water House in Mill Run, Pennsylvania. Marina City in Chicago pioneered the city within a city idea and was built with funds from the Janitors Union. Low-income housing has been a challenge in American urban life since the tenement days of New York's Lower East Side. And the Langston Terrace dwellings in Washington, D.C. are a novel, designed approach to housing the poor.
But the number of places that blacks could live were very limited. Those tenements, those tightly packed slums, those were not consciously designed by an architect.
As a child, I didn't know anything about designs, modern design. I just knew that it was beautiful.
Eloise Greenfield was an early resident of Langston Terrace, and her voice and others are a part of a three-part series from PBS and Chicago station WTTW that debuts tonight. 10 That Changed America, with 10 homes, 10 parks, and 10 cities selected. This evening's episode is 10 Homes That Changed America. Reid Kroloff is a former editor-in-chief of Architecture Magazine and a nationally recognized commentator in architecture and urban design.
Langston Terrace is very significant. It's one of the very, very first pieces of federally funded public housing in the U.S. and the very first in Washington, D.C. And then it's one of the most significant pieces of architecture done by an African-American architect at a time when there truly were almost none.
How did, first of all, the Langston Terrace dwellings avoid or embrace some of the mistakes that we associate with public housing? The giant centralized housing projects in Chicago, the mistakes in Detroit and New York. What makes the Langston Terrace dwellings so different? And did having an African-American architect bear on that?
I think it did bear on that. The lead architect, Hilliard Robinson, you had him practicing in Washington, D.C., building what would be the first federally funded housing project in this city. And he knew people would be looking at it as they drove by it, but also they'd be looking at it for political reasons, both positive and negative. And he wanted to make sure that people understood, A, that public housing could be a good thing, could be a beautiful thing, B, that there was a reason to bring the federal government in, which was to help change attitudes about African Americans and where they lived and how they lived, but also attitudes about whether the government can and should be involved in this kind of activity. And then finally, whether African Americans can, in fact, produce professional quality architecture, in his case, just like white people can. And he was well aware of all three of those and very intent on delivering a positive message that, yes, in fact, all of those things can be executed successfully.
How did the choices that he made as an architect portray that this was a worthy project and not some sort of dumping ground for, you know, people who were too poor to be a part of mainstream society in Washington, D.C.?
The two most important aspects of this would be, number one, the buildings are beautifully designed to create what are elegant, quiet, minimalist buildings influenced by Dutch modernism of the 1920s and 30s and by the Bauhaus of the same, almost the same period. And then secondly, beautiful master planning. The buildings are laid out on their site very intelligently to encourage community development and landscaped beautifully by an African-American landscape architect. So the quality of design and then intelligent planning and landscape really makes this project stand out. And it does look different. When you drive by it, it does not look anything like the images that you were bringing up earlier about these massive central units that are a much smaller scale. There's plenty of open landscape. It's a very, very nice set of buildings.
I'm noticing that in the series, Marina City in Chicago is also one of these projects.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's very different than what we were discussing in Langston Terrace, but the success of Marina City and the interest in Marina City is contained within its name. It isn't the Marina Towers or Marina Point. It implies, as its architect and developer wanted it to, that it is an entire city unto itself. So there's the two apartment towers, there's the integrated parking right below them, there's an enormous performance venue, a grocery store, a gym, all of the kinds of things that you might need to make a life in the city. Now, they just happen to have an exceptional architectural expression as well. Those buildings are so iconic, and I hate that word, but they're so exceptional on the landscape.
They're, I mean, they're even more recognizable, it seems to me, than Sears Tower and Hancock Center. And when I first saw them, when I went to the University of Chicago, I thought they were like, you know, a record company headquarters or something like that. You know, Capitol Records would be there or something.
I think part of the power of those buildings, A, is they're round, and no matter how often we see them, we still never quite get used to the notion of a round building or a cylindrical building in that case. And number two, there's two of them, John, and they're right next to each other. Every time you twin something, there's a power in that twinning. They look as if they're having a conversation. So it's like two beautiful, elegant, tall people standing there conversing.
How does the notion of public planning and thoughtful public use of land get embodied in both of these projects in the PBS series? Because the idea of public anything has been degraded, I think, in our time. Maybe that's ending now, but it certainly was not a popular concept in the 80s and 90s.
It certainly got a bum rap because people saw example after example after example of projects where public funding was engaged that were mismanaged and allowed to get into terrible conditions or were seen as the breeding grounds for crime. And those impressions were not wrong. But it wasn't because those places couldn't be good simply because they had public investment. It was because we misunderstood that public investment is not a one-time or upfront cost. It's something that must continue if we want to get full benefit. And it's not a hard concept to understand. You don't buy your home and then never take care of it after that. You buy your home and you pour money into it. We have, unfortunately, too much of a sense in public life that once you've made the investment, we built Langston Terrace, now let those folks take care of themselves. And that's just not how it works.
Reid Kroloff is former editor-in-chief of Architecture Magazine and a nationally recognized commentator in architecture and urban design. Thanks so much, Reid.
Thank you, John.
And here's something to take with you today in that vein. The importance of low-income housing and the quest to make cities livable for all is relevant today and even more urgent in places like Bridgeport, Connecticut. In the 1960s, you could go to what locals called the hole in the Father Panic Village. 47 buildings, a poor community with 5,000 residents. You could get drugs, you could watch shooting, you could watch hookers working. The kids who grew up in Panic Village are still alive with those grim memories, and some of them have a new chance. Today, what was once the worst, most crime-ridden project in the state has become the Crescent Crossing Project. Under construction in Bridgeport right now, the first residents will move in this summer, some from that old Panic development from the 1960s. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.